A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Okay, showtime, here we go.
Don't touch that dial.
The world's most dangerous form of radio. Talk radio. Media Network, putting the bang into world bang radio.
Hello, and once again, thanks for your cards and letters, even cassette recordings that keep us going. First, a follow-up to an item Arthur Cushion mentioned in last week's wireless programme. You may remember he logged a station from New York.
It's on 1560 kHz at 0700 with Jazz. The station is WQEW. Now, WQEW used to be WQXR, operated by the New York Times, but now it's new owners and new calls.
Well, not quite. Steve Coletti was one of many to react to that item. In fact, WQEW is still owned by the New York Times. The classical AM transmitter had no listeners, though. That was the problem, and was kept alive because of its tradition. It started as an experimental hi-fi station with the call sign W2XR way back in 1936. All the programming was simulcast on FM and is still heard on WQXR 96.3 MHz in New York. The management's considered changing the AM format for years, though. The ideas included going to an all-financial news format or an all-children's programme. Then another station, WNEW, was sold to the Bloomberg News Service and went to a business format as WBBR 1130 kHz. Now, the old WNEW had made its name with a big band format, whereas WQXR had done so with classical music. So all they did was to take the Q from QXR, EW from the other station, to make the new big band station, WQEW. Steve says that the station does have some specialty programming, though, including some jazz, which is what he thinks Arthur heard. And in fact, the station has its second birthday this week.
Radio Netherlands, where creative production lives on.
More updates to recent items we've carried, so we can pass on some extra info which has come in. First to Zimbabwe, and that country's shortwave service was officially opened by President Robert Mugabe on December the 5th. It seems that the US firm of TCI got the turnkey contract. There are two log periodic antennas and two continental 100 kilowatt transmitters at the old traditional shortwave centre of Guinea Fowl, near the town of Gweru in the centre of Zimbabwe. Diana Yonza has more details now on another part of Africa, where radio has played a major role in the tragedy surrounding Rwanda. It's a sad story of good and evil.
Earlier this year, a radio station run by Hutu extremists encouraged its followers to commit genocide against the Tutsis. Radio di Mille Collines, or Radio of a Thousand Hills, was instrumental in the human suffering that followed. As Tutsi streamed across the border with Zaire, help organizations were faced with a severe communications problem. Radio de Mille Collines went off the air in mid-July. Shortly afterwards, the Swiss branch of the group Reporters Without Frontiers gathered together equipment and, with support from UNESCO, went into Goma and Bukavu. On August the 5th, they opened a transmitter called Radio Gatashia, the Bird of Hope. It broadcast health and welfare information to the Rwandans in the refugee camps. Now it seems that Radio Gatashia has gone off the air, but Radio de Mille Collines could be trying to come back. Hervé Deguin is responsible for African affairs at Reporters Without Frontiers in Paris. He's concerned about the developments.
There is a threat. Gaspard Gaidi, the former editor-in-chief of the radio station, declared a few days ago to AFP that he still has all the material to start with Radio de Mille Collines. Personally, I am not sure he speaks the truth. I think he says that to frighten the journalists or the Tutsis, but I'm not sure it is true. The second point on the other side is that Gaspard Gaigi started a new newspaper, which name is Ami Zero, and in which are working many former journalists from Radio des Mille Collines. And this newspaper is now circulating in Goma, in Bukavu, and in other places where are many Hutus extremists. But there is another, by the way, there is another newspaper, extremist newspaper, which is circulating again. It's Kongora, a famous newspaper which published a few years ago the law for the good Hutu, if I can say, explaining that they had to kill Tutsis and so on. So you see, there are two extremist newspapers now in Goma and one organization, which is Association des Journalistes Rwandais en Exil, and obviously they are preparing the revenge. It's very easy for them to buy some new equipment if the old one have been destroyed. It's very easy for them to broadcast from Zaire. I think that Zairean soldiers might not be able to prevent it. And this is why we started an action with the Security Council and the United Nations to prevent such a possibility.
And what's Radio Gatashia doing about the situation?
Well, Radio Gatashia in Goma stopped broadcasting on the 31 of October for different reasons.
What were those reasons?
Well, mostly because the radio station was supposed to cope with the emergency in Goma, and 3 months after the rush of refugees in Goma, we thought that this was no longer the mandate of Reporters sans Frontières to continue this radio station. The other point is political. We didn't want to become the radio of the community of refugees in Goma, which was a risk. And the third one, the question of security. As you probably know, we started different actions against many of the extremist journalists who were committed in genocide. And every time we published communique or we went to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, the team in Goma received have been threatened, and it became more and more dangerous. There have been a different appreciation of the opportunity to continue or to stop the radio station, but there was a meeting here in Paris on October the 8th, and the decision was taken to close the radio station in Goma on the 31 of October and the radio station in Bukavu on the 31 of December.
And will Radio Gatashia come back on the air?
No, it will not, and neither will a radio handled by Reporters sans Frontières start in Kigali. In Goma, in Bukavu, and in Kigali, we don't want anymore to have a radio station controlled by Reporters sans Frontières, but if we can support a local radio station project, but this time controlled by Rwandese journalists doing themselves their own work, we will do it, of course.
Hervé Deguin on the line from Paris. Now, a feature from Moscow, because this year, Russia's external broadcasting service is celebrating its 65th anniversary. Radio Netherlands East European project specialist Frans Suasso paid a birthday visit to the international radio giant.
Every country claims to have had something to do with the invention of radio. Holland started shortwave broadcasting in 1927. International radio started in Russia 2 years later, but in fact trials with radio communication started much earlier. Alexander Popov, a physics professor at Kronstadt Naval Institute near St. Petersburg, made the first experiment with electromagnetic waves in the 1890s. During the First World War, the Germans listened in to Russian military communications, which were being put out in Morse code over the radio because landlines had been cut. As a result of their interception activities, the Russians lost the Battle of Tannenberg in eastern Poland. So it became clear that radio could reach a lot of listeners at once. The Communist Party was suffering from a lack of politically reliable teachers to travel throughout the country and educate the masses. In 1922, Lenin realized that radio broadcasting was the solution to the problem, and in one of his speeches proclaimed, "When the newspaper is being read aloud in Moscow, the whole of the country can hear it." Domestic radio broadcasting started in the Soviet Union in 1924, with international broadcasts following 5 years later. I talked to Boris Yefimovich Belitsky, who started working for Radio Moscow in 1945 and has been the science correspondent on the English service for many years. He recalls the early days.
That was the Stalin period. It was a very, very difficult time for broadcasters. There was very strict censorship. There was no leeway. Everything had to be recorded. There was no live broadcasting at all. We had enormous problems with the censorship. The name Stalin was often, say, preceded by the adjective «гениальный Сталин» in Russian, which means Stalin with an adjective derived from the noun genius. Now, that is something that is possible in Russian, but you cannot possibly make an adjective out of genius in English. So, of course, we had to omit it or use some other word for it. And I remember the censors coming after us with a very stern and ominous look and saying, "Now, look, the Russian text here says гениальный Сталин, and where is that adjective in English?" And we would have to try to explain to them that it is impossible in English to turn the word genius into an adjective. And sometimes they were not very convinced. And I would say that some of us didn't sleep nights after things like that, because in those days the penalties could be terrible.
And what could the penalties be?
The penalties could be anything from dismissal to the gulag. I recall one of our translators, for example, an American by the name of Friedman, who vanished in the purges in the late 40s. There were many others. A few people returned, much the worse for their experiences in the gulag. We were very glad to have them back, of course. We did our best to help them recover from their experiences, but many vanished.
When did the first changes occur?
Well, the first changes, of course, began to make themselves felt after Stalin's death, not immediately, but they really began in Khrushchev's time, the period we call the thaw in our history. That was when things became a little more relaxed. For the first time, we began to read the news live. It had always been recorded, out of fear that the announcer might insert something into it. We began to read the news live. We began live broadcasting. I was able to, say, do live broadcasts from Red Square during the anniversary parades and things like that. But the real dramatic changes came only with Gorbachev, with Gorbachev's policy of glasnost. It was only then that we were able to really speak our minds, report things impartially, and give our listeners a real, frank picture of the situation in the country.
As a part of the 65th anniversary celebrations, Radio Moscow changed its name to The Voice of Russia. The station's president is Armen Oganesyan, who says ideology has now been replaced by information.
The main thing is that journalists and creative workers, as we would say, they have changed drastically their approach towards information, towards the events in the world. They're not preoccupied with the stereotypes and schemes that... But the interesting and peculiar thing, and I very often is asked about, was it very difficult, this transformation, the conscious and all this? No, absolutely. Because people were ready to change. Being under this oppression, psychological oppression, that they had to write what they very often not think is true. They thought, they knew, actually, that that was not true. But it is easier for a man to pronounce truth than lie. So when I am asked, was it torturous, I mean, this transformation? No, it's always easier to transform from lie to truth than vice versa.
For financial reasons mainly, you had to stop, to end transmissions in programming in a number of languages. All international broadcasters are threatened, more or less all, by financial cuts. Do you expect any more drastic cuts for the Voice of Russia in the foreseeable future?
Well, I can't predict any more drastic cuts. I hope this will not take place. Well, we actually got 8 languages. But the structure was such that you had to go to every tribe just to propagate Marxism-Leninism. And any small tribe and exotic languages you are to broadcast in them just to cover the whole...
Exotic languages like Dutch, for instance?
Yeah. No. That's another thing. We closed some broadcasting in, for example, in Northern Europe. Why? English is a language which actually a taxi driver can speak and understand. And you have many channels in English. And the signal, our signal from Moscow, coming from World Service of Radio Moscow, in English, covering this area. By the way, the same thing with Africa. We drop, for example, Afrikaans, a very exotic language. People there know English. They know this language. So I don't think these cards are very much detrimental to our image and profile in the world. And 38 languages, after all, it's quite a number of languages.
Meters away from Red Square, in one of the oldest streets in Moscow, is the main center for broadcasting networks. This organization controls the many hundreds of radio transmitters on Russian territory and all the program modulation lines. Some international broadcasters, including Radio Netherlands, currently use the main center's transmitters. Anatoly Timofeyevich Titov is the head of the main broadcasting center. In fact, the man who controls the world's largest radio broadcasting operation. It's from this building that the first radio broadcast in Russia took place in the 1920s.
Первый передатчик внутри российского вещания был на Ходынке. Ходынское поле это сейчас Хорошевское.
The first transmitter to go on the air was here in Moscow at a place called Kharkovskoye Shosse. But it didn't get far enough, so more powerful transmitters were constructed at Elektrostal, Noginsk, and eventually throughout the country.
Some of the transmitter site names are interesting. Elektrostal may sound rather uninspiring, but in those days anything to do with heavy industry had an immediate connection with the success of communist ideology. Parents even called their sons Lokomotiv in honor of the party's industrial revolution. Komsomolsk, another transmitter site, got its name from the Communist Youth League.
Передатчики в основном на вещании были 100-киловаттные передатчики кратковолновые.
For broadcasts abroad, we initially used 100-kilowatt shortwave transmitters, which in those days were more than adequate to reach North America, even from Moscow. But, of course, over the years, competition came from other stations, and the power race started. Transmitters were originally built in Moscow and later in Leningrad. There was a huge factory called Komintern, which not only built relatively low-power 150-kilowatt transmitters, but also constructed powerful senders, anything up to 500 kilowatts. When they got to the transmitter site, engineers then modified them to get even more power output. They also linked transmitters together so that the total output was raised to 2,000 kilowatts. Alternatively, they synchronized two transmitters on the same frequency, each feeding its own antenna. Virtually all the transmitters were built in the Soviet Union.
Все передатчики практически были построены в Советском Союзе.
Nikolai Mikhailovich Mishkov took me on a tour of one of the control rooms where international broadcasts for the Voice of Russia are switched to the various transmitter sites across the country and beyond. Russia has also signed contracts with several international broadcasters. Programs from the BBC, Deutsche Welle, VOA and Radio Netherlands are received by satellite dishes on the roof of the control center and are also brought into this switching center. Three women technicians sit behind a huge control panel.
На двух программах мы сейчас можем посмотреть, как работает программа, как Optimod работает.
We've installed the Radio Netherlands Optimod units into this control room. It boosts the signal that we get off the UTELSAT satellite, and it makes sure as much audio energy as possible is sent off to the transmitter sites. At some times of the day, Radio Netherlands now feeds two programs simultaneously to this switching center.
И на вещание идут еще и программы.
Apart from programmes by the Voice of Russia, there are also programmes from the BBC and VOA. There are three control rooms. In this one, we can handle 25 different radio programmes running at the same time and switch them to no less than 140 output lines from this building. They get to the transmitter site in two different ways. We have point-to-point links via satellite, but there's also a large terrestrial network of landlines. If we put programmes onto this network, then any transmitter site along the huge chain can tap into the same programming. It's just coming up to the hour, and we're going to switch this satellite feed in a moment. The settings are being checked. When the studio in Moscow has finished the programme, a light on the panel goes on. We confirm that we're about to switch to another programming source. Then we warn the next studio that they're about to go on the air. Once everything's been lined up, then the connections are established by pressing a button. So the switching's complete. And there's the interval signal.
Our reporter in Moscow was Françoise, here on Radio Netherlands. From one sign-on to another, last week we reported that Christian Voice had signed on in Zambia. Andy James is the project director at Christian Vision, a religious organisation based in central England. He's just returned from Zambia, so we asked him for more details about their station.
We've been working for the last 6 months constructing the station, and on the 1st of December we actually launched. We were honoured to have the President of Zambia, President Frederick Chiluba, to formally open the station. So, 1st of December, we started broadcast 6065 kilohertz shortwave.
And are you on the air around the clock?
Initially, we're broadcasting for 6.5 hours. We've been granted a 3 months provisional licence so that we can do field tests to make sure that, obviously, we are reaching the places that we were wanting to. But within 3 months, we're hoping then to expand the programming to be really from 6 o'clock in the morning right through to 11 o'clock at night.
So you're hoping to reach a radius of about, 1,500 kilometres?
Well, that was certainly the intention. It looks like from initial reports that are coming back, we're actually doing that with a very, very good signal.
If people do hear you then, how do they get back to you in terms of what's the address?
OK, they can write to Christian Voice, Private Bag E606, Lusaka, Zambia.
And you have a fax number there?
OK, the code for Zambia is 260, then 1, and then the number is 274251.
And where are the programmes coming from?
Well, there are some obviously being made in Zambia, and others are coming from the UK and from sources around Europe and America.
Is it all religious programming?
No, we've got quite a varied program lineup. Everything from health, education, obviously there's some entertainment, and there's going to be Christian teaching and training.
The latest schedule we have on 6065 kilohertz is from 14 to 2030 hours UTC. Steve Witt in the UK supplies some more information about Waves AM, a low-power temporary radio station in Petershead, Scotland, due on the air on December 17th, right up until January the 1st, on 1566 kilohertz. The station can be contacted at 100 Watson Crescent, Petershead, AB426WS in Scotland. It's run by a chap called Norman Spence, who's keen to hear from listeners, it seems. This is their sixth time on the air with tests. Earlier this year, they were heard in Norway, and it seems by a fishing boat 60 miles north of the Shetlands. Hugh Reese gave us a call to ask about delivery problems we might be having with our winter programme schedule on target. Indeed, we're investigating why a batch of English schedules posted in Costa Rica 5 weeks ago still haven't arrived.
Radio Netherlands. Continental Talk Radio.
Joining me now is Andy Sennett, editor of the World Radio TV Handbook. And Andy, I suppose we're not far off the 1995 edition.
That's right. It's at the printers at the moment, and it should be ready for shipping at the end of the month. So the first copies ought to be reaching our North American readers in early January. For the rest of the world, the majority of copies are shipped by sea and will therefore take a few weeks longer. But we've also just received first copies of the 1995 WRTH Satellite Broadcasting Guide, written and produced by my colleague Bart Kupiris, and the books are now being shipped to our various distributors. So if you've ordered one, it shouldn't be long now.
Which reminds me that the people who won one of those satellite broadcasting guides in the competition earlier this year will also be getting it soon. OK, more on those books in a future programme. Meanwhile, what's been happening as far as media news is concerned?
Well, the good news is that the legendary British offshore station Radio Caroline is back on the air on medium wave from its ship, the Ross Revenge. The bad news is they're using a power of just 1 watt on 1584 kilohertz. This is another short-term operation. They're licensed for 1 month, which means that if you live in the area immediately around the estuary of the River Blackwater in Essex, you can enjoy Radio Caroline over Christmas and the New Year, at least during daytime when the frequency's clear. They can be heard as far away as Gillingham in Kent, according to Kelvin Frey on CompuServe, and if you do manage to hear the station, they'll take your reception reports by phone on 44, if you're dialing from outside the UK, area code 881-102-090.
I'm surprised you actually give the area codes there, bearing in mind that it's only 1 watt. It's broadcasting the next door, as far as I'm concerned. We've been listening on that frequency, and it's very difficult to hear anything, actually, on 1584 here in the Netherlands. Still, moving a bit further afield, what about reception from Chechnya, where there's currently a conflict going on?
Well, that's a difficult catch, Jonathan, I'm afraid. There are two transmitters listed for the city of Grozny, where the local people have declared independence from Russia, and as we speak, Russian forces are attempting to restore control from Moscow. Now, exactly who's in charge of the radio station at this moment isn't clear. There's a 50-kilowatt transmitter on 657 kilohertz, 657. That does carry some local programming. And there's a low-power transmitter of 7 kilowatts on 1287 kilohertz, 1287, which is listed as carrying Radio Stanciya Unist from Moscow. Neither of these transmitters is easy to hear outside the official coverage area. In fact, WRTH co-editor Ola Alm in Sweden tells me that 657 kilohertz has never been heard in Scandinavia. And also on that frequency, there's a 150-kilowatt station in Murmansk. So even if you do hear some Russian, it's more likely to be that.
OK, but I believe there have been other transmissions from Chechnya in the past.
Yes, until a couple of months ago, the high-power Krasnodar transmitter on 1089 kilohertz, 1089, that carried some news bulletins in Russian concerning the situation in Chechnya at midnight and 02 hours UTC. They use the name Radio Stanciya Demos, and the audio quality, according to Ola, was very poor. But these transmissions stopped in mid-October. However, it might be worth checking out 1089 as the situation develops, especially as it's a fairly clear frequency in this part of Europe at the moment, because the new commercial station, Talk Radio UK, hasn't started yet.
OK, let's go to shortwave, where despite the low sunspot count, there are still plenty of things to be heard.
Yes, but this next item only just qualifies as shortwave. Every once in a while, a real gem of a DX catch turns up, and Don Moore in Iowa, USA, has come up with one. On the 12th of December, Don heard a medium-wave station from San Andres Island, Colombia, on what appears to be its second harmonic, 2200 kHz. I say appears to be because the station announces 1110 kHz, and that's in fact where we list them in the WRTH. But Don heard them on 2200 kHz exactly, between 0315 and 0411 UTC, and there were clear identifications on the hour and half hour as La Voz de las Islas, Frecuencia Colombiana en la Alta Mar. So that means they must be operating on 1100 kHz rather than 1110. By the way, Don posted that information on the internet just a few hours after he heard it, so hopefully by now a few other people have heard it too.
There's also something interesting coming up from HCJB in Ecuador.
Yes, on Wednesday the 21st of December, a programme called the HCJB Story, hosted by John Beck, is going to air, and that'll be telling the story of the birth of HCJB on Christmas Day 1931. And the programme includes an interview with the founder of the station, Clarence Jones. That goes out at 07:30, 10 hours and 17 hours UTC on the 21st, and listeners in North America can hear it on the 22nd at 01 and 05 hours UTC. That's, of course, Wednesday evening local time.
And there's also something else of interest to listeners in that area.
Yes, I don't normally mention the so-called free radio stations, but I noticed this interesting item in the latest DX magazine from the Worldwide DX Club. Apparently, German station Radio Marabu, which is well known to DXers in this part of Europe, has started broadcasting via Radio Copan International in Honduras. Their programmes go out on the last Friday of the month, between 20 and 21 hours UTC, on 15675 kHz, 15675, and the target area is the Northern Caribbean and Eastern North America.
Coming up next week, all being well, we're planning to look at new ways to get radio data over shortwave, and thus aid the tuning process. A conference has just concluded in Hong Kong, where they think they have the answer. In the meantime, our phone lines and fax machines are standing by. Have a nice weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1994.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static. Some people get far off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.